and the need to walk back to the bunk room, slide under a blanket, and disappear. There were a few kids lingering around the space. One was working at the table along the opposite wall, her back hiding whatever it was she was doing. The others were playing cards on a blanket they'd spread out over the floor. It was strange to me that they were down here instead of using the chairs and tables in the big room upstairs, where it had to be at least 20 degrees warmer. I stepped forward, wrapping my arms around my center to try to trap some warmth in. There was a sticky pull at the bottom of my shoes. I glanced at the ground and immediately jumped away. A large white crescent moon. Someone must have painted it there earlier in the night. Liam had his back to me as he crouched down, working on the motorbike he'd found. Its gray shell of grime had been polished away, and the silver accents and black panels gleamed under his care. It looked like he'd just brought it home from the store. He stood up suddenly, reaching for a piece of foam, and started to wrap it over the bike seat to cover the gashes in the leather.
"I like what you've done with the place!"
I had to shout over Mick Jagger to be heard. The radio stood a foot away from my feet, and somehow I had the feeling that I didn't have the right to turn it off. You listened to music this loudly to drown out everyone and everything, letting the rhythm and beats flow around you like a shield. Liam spun around, startled. His white shirt was spotted with oil and dust, and somehow, clearly without realizing it, he'd managed to wipe some of it across his forehead and cheek. It was disarming how good he looked to me, how much I wanted to go straight toward him, take his face in between my hands and kiss him and kiss him and kiss him until that carefree smile was back. It made me forget everything that had happened between the start of this and now. My mind was still on blown-out tires, socks, and the Beach Boys, even as he said, "What's wrong?"
"Nothing," I managed. I was worried when you didn't show up for Lights Out. I wanted to
make sure I didn't run away."
"Really?"
He started to turn back to his bike, but stopped midway, pressing his hand to his forehead.
"Oh, damn. I did do that, didn't I? That was not Nashville, right?"
The small bubble of contented memory popped around me. It was Oklahoma, at the national park.
"Right, right. That's the last foggy part, right before you..."
He waved a hand through the air.
"Sorry, we need a clock in here."
My eyes drifted over his profile, the line of his jaw, and I thought with crushing certainty, I'm not wanted here.
"Okay, well,"
I said, forcing a horrible brightness into my voice.
"Okay, I'm just going to get going."
My throat was aching by the time I finally got the words out, and I had a feeling they didn't make sense either. Stupid, so stupid. I'd wanted distance, hadn't I? I hadn't wanted to talk to him about everything, and now it was like I'd forgotten how to talk to him entirely. I got a step away when the music got quieter, and he called out,
"I'm thinking of calling her Lovely Rita. What do you think?"
In spite of everything, I felt myself smile.
"Like the Beatles song?"
He was leaning against the motorbike seat, his legs out in front of him, his arms crossed over his chest. I made a mental amendment. This was the best thing I'd ever seen. This was the first time Liam had looked like Liam in months. From his wild, kept running his hands through it hair, to the way his jeans were slung low on his hips.
"Fits, right?"
he said, offering the smallest, sweetest little smile.
"Isn't Rita a meter maid?"
I asked, walking back over to him, my heart thrumming in my chest. Liam was watching me so intently, I almost tripped over my own careless feet. The warmth that pooled at my center threatened to spark when his arm slid forward, his hands turned up, toward me. I stepped into the circle of them and leaned against his shoulder.
"Yeah,"
he said quietly,
"but she's so lovely."
My hand slid up along his back, and I was relieved that it was as hot to the touch as I felt. I wanted to ask him about the drive up, what the people they made contact with had been like, but it seemed enough to just be held, to feel him kiss my hair, my cheek. I leaned back, looking up at his face. One of his hands moved, sliding into the back pocket of my jeans. He was still watching me when I reached up and tried to thumb some of the oil off his face.
"Damn," he said, chuckling. "How much of a mess am I right now?"
"You are perfect." My fingers and eyes shifted down to the pale scar at the right corner of his mouth and felt the first touch of something dark and insistent pressing at the back of my mind. "How did you get this scar?" I asked. I just needed to hear it from him, to confirm what I'd seen locked inside Cole's mind. "I never asked you."
"It's a good thing you didn't," he said,
reaching up to catch my hand and hold it in his.
"There's not a good story to it. I've had it forever. Cole told me I got it when he pushed me off his bed."
I closed my eyes, let out a soft breath, and when he kissed me, I let it chase the truth away. "Cole said you called Harry to help find where they brought Kate," I said. "Thank you. Thank you so much. I know you're trying to keep them out of this."
Liam laughed. "Like I could ever keep Harry or Mom from getting themselves in trouble. Zoo's story pretty much proved that."
"You got to talk to them?"
"Yeah, I used one of the extra burner phones," he said. "It was amazing to hear their voices. It felt like it had been forever since the last time."
I ran a hand up and down his arm. I was thrilled for him. Honestly thrilled beyond anything I thought possible. Enough, at least, to ignore the small pang of jealousy in the corner of my heart that was still bruised.
"I was worried he wouldn't accept Harry's help," Liam continued. "The two of them have knocked heads since day one."
"Why is that?" I asked. "If he hated his biological father the way I knew he did, then why push back so hard against Harry?"
He shrugged. "Cole used to act out a lot when we were kids, and Mom didn't have the heart to discipline him after everything that happened with our bio dad, so Harry had to do it. And you know, he's a great, loving, super funny guy, but he can be strict. He spent years in the military."
"And Cole has never liked being told what to do," I finished. That, and I was sure that once the change came over him, and he developed terrifying abilities he had to fight to control, he spent most of his childhood angry and afraid of being found out. I swallowed hard at the thought, unable to speak. If he'd just tell Liam.
"I think he was... I'm not sure this is going to make sense, but I don't know that Cole ever let himself trust Harry. He remembers more of what it was like when our father was around, and he feels protective of Mom, which I do get, but it's like he's waiting for Harry to let us down, to hurt us, and Harry never would. I think he joined the League just to spite Harry, actually."
"Maybe working together now will help Cole learn to trust him," I offered.
"That's what Harry's hoping. For the record, I hope so too."
Liam pressed a kiss to my hair again before pulling back.
"All right, I'm tuckered out."
I wasn't tired in the slightest anymore, and I had a feeling he wasn't either, not really. I kissed the scar at the corner of his lips, running my hands up his neck and burying them in his hair. His pale blue eyes seemed to darken as he leaned down to meet me halfway. Someone coughed behind us, and coughed again. Liam said something uncharacteristically vulgar under his breath as he pulled back, his face flushed and his eyes a bit too wild.
"Yeah."
It was the girl who'd been working at the table. She was a blue who'd come in with Zoo's ragtag group. Elizabeth. That was her name. Liza.
"I finished, but I'm not sure it looks... I think it might look more like a white banana."
She held up a black helmet for the two of us to inspect. painted along one side was what looked to my eye like a crescent moon. Liam's arms tensed around my waist.
"It looks great," he said.
"Well, you know what it's supposed to be. But what if she can't?" Liza said.
"She?" I repeated.
"Our contact," Liam said quickly. "Senator Cruz's, I mean. When I go to pick up supplies, she wanted something to identify me."
"But won't you be driving a car or truck?" I asked.
"Not the bike."
He hesitated, standing up and away from the bike. I saw the effort of his concentration as he turned a smiling face back on me.
"Sometimes the bike, depending on the situation, will paint one of the doors of the trucks, too."
I don't know what it was exactly. The odd tone of his voice, the way Liza all but bolted, her face pale, how quick he was to take my hand and start guiding us back toward the tunnel. Every thought that passed through his head had always registered on Liam's face, good or bad. Seeing his carefully blank face, half hidden by the shadows in the tunnel, I pieced together the realization. He was keeping secrets, too. Vida and Chubbs left the next morning, long before the sun came up. Liam, Zoo, and I were all there to see them off at the tunnel's entrance. Regardless of whether or not we'd been planning on it, the two of them had been bickering so loudly from the moment the alarm on Liam's watch went off that none of us had any chance of falling back asleep. Nico and Cole showed up a few minutes later, both pale and drained with an exhaustion that hadn't come with waking up at that ungodly hour, but staying awake to meet it. It set me on edge, the way they wouldn't make eye contact with any of us. When I asked Cole what was going on, he only said,
"We'll talk about it after."
As Vito went over the map one last time with Liam and Cole, I pulled Chubbs aside and walked him a short ways down the hall. I could see him fighting inside himself for some composure. Chubbs was so ruled by his head, by logic, that he didn't have a coping mechanism for when powerful emotions threatened his careful process. I don't think he was afraid for himself, so much as afraid of what could happen while they were gone.
"Don't do anything stupid," he started. "Be safe. Make sure that you seek out proper medical attention."
"Isn't that the lecture I'm supposed to be giving you?" I asked.
"Yo, no time to chat and hug it out," Vida called. "Let's get cracking."
Chubbs held up a finger to signal to the others that we needed a minute. Vida let out an impatient snort, then turned a very different finger in his direction.
"I have no doubt you guys are going to pull this off," I began. "But how are you going to get through it without one of you strangling the other?"
"Well, we're pretty evenly matched," he said reasonably. "She has the brawn, I have the brains. Either both of us will come back, or neither of us will, because we'll have clawed each other's throats out."
"Don't even joke about it," I whispered.
"I have to joke about it. Otherwise, I'll probably start crying."
Chubbs's face suddenly looked as drawn as I felt. "You don't have to go if you don't want to," I said quickly. "It's not too late."
"Isn't it? Besides, I have to pull my weight, too."
He shrugged with a nonchalance that looked unnatural on him. His voice sounded strained, filtered through a lump in his throat. "You and Vida will both be fine," I said, planting both hands on his shoulders and forcing him to look down and meet my gaze. "You have everything under control. You'll both be careful and quick and back in one piece." Chubbs turned back toward Vida, who was the only person I knew who could make pacing look like prowling.
"Well,"
he amended with a long, suffering look,
"hopefully no more than two pieces."
Despite what Vida had said, she waited patiently as Chubbs knelt to talk to Zoo and gave Liam a good pounding on the back. Cole unlocked the door, letting a draft of cold air into the hallway, and stood back as Chubbs took the first few steps down. As much faith as I had in them, I did have to fight off the urge to throw myself in front of the tunnel out and block their path. I pressed a hand against my chest, trying to stamp the feeling of panic out. But Zoo had no such reservations. She bolted out of Liam's grip and pushed past Cole, who was shutting the door after them.
By the time we caught up to them, she was gripping their packs, her heels digging into the unfinished floor, crying in that silent, heartbreaking way, crying harder than I'd ever seen. She shook her head, her lips moving with silent pleas. Chubbs looked back at us, startled. Zoo had been the toughest of our group in many ways, the one quickest to bounce back after terror or sadness knocked her flat. Whatever walls she'd built up to keep the feelings from cresting, they weren't high enough now to stop the desperate fear. And it devastated me. My throat ached with the need to cry, too. Vida dropped her pack and knelt down in front of her.
"Hey, girl, none of that.
It's like what we talked about, yeah?" Zoo pressed her face against Chubbs's backpack. "What happened to you with that guy? The one who drove you to California? That was some..."
I saw her catch herself, modify her word choice. "That was some messed up stuff. And I'm sorry. I'm really sorry that it happened to him. But me and Charlie Boy, we're coming back.
None of us are going to leave you here alone. We take care of our family, right?"
I didn't realize Liam still had a hand on my shoulder until it tightened. His face was ashen.
That calmed Zoo down, at least enough to release her grip on Chubbs and turn toward Vida fully.
"You can trust me, Z. I won't let you down, okay?"
She nodded, scrubbing at her face with her sleeve. Vida held up her fist for a bump, but Zoo one-upped her, wrapping her bony arms around the older girl's neck. Vida said something too low for any of the rest of us to hear, but when Zoo pulled back, she was nodding, a look of fierce determination on her face. With no other warning, she turned and hugged Chubbs, too, looking back to point a finger toward Vida as if to say, "Be nice."
"I told you," Vida said as she stood. "I keep my promises."
Liam stepped forward to guide Zoo back into the hallway so she didn't have to watch the door shut and lock behind them. I saw her straighten herself out, her fists clenching at her sides and her chin lifting up, the same way I'd seen Vida prep herself for battle.
"Let's go get something to eat, okay?"
Liam said. He looked back over his shoulder.
"Coming?"
I shook my head. "Have to shower and take care of a few things. I'll catch up with you later." Liam waved and started walking with Zoo back down the hall, heading to the kitchen in the lower level.
"Okay, what's going on?" I asked before either Cole or Nico could speak. "What happened last night?"
"It's easier to show you."
Cole started past me, heading the same way his brother had taken, toward the stairs. I followed him silently, watching Nico watch the floor, my stomach clenching. It was getting too hard to pretend like I didn't care. It was the first time I'd been down in the computer room since the supplies had come in last night. Where there had once been only one laptop, there were now 5 desktops. Another 3 silver laptops were spaced out along the desks, which were still pushed against the walls, leaving an empty space at the center of the room for planning. I spotted a printer and a scanner near the old laptop. Nico had picked a seat at the far back corner of the room, as usual. Cole brushed aside printouts of indecipherable code from one of the nearby seats and offered it to me. Nico keyed in some kind of a password and brought up a window of more code.
"Somehow this doesn't feel easier," I said. "What are we looking at?"
"This is our server log," Nico said. "It seemed like it was lagging last night, so I was trying to troubleshoot what the issue was. This right here,"
he pointed to the screen.
"That means someone sent one of the files saved there, transferring it via FTP to another encrypted server."
"What file?" I asked.
"It was one of the videos from the Thurmond testing," Cole said. "But there's more."
Nico scrolled up.
"There are gaps in the server's activity log, all between the hours of midnight and 4 a.m. on 2 other days."
"It's not because no one was awake to use the computers?" I asked.
Nico shook his head.
"We've been leaving the computers on overnight to transfer everything to remote backup servers in case ours fail. There would have been huge spikes of activity, but look."
The huge spikes of activity were there, beginning at 11 o'clock in the evening, but abruptly cutting off at 2 in the morning, only to resume 4 hours later, right around the time Nico or another Green would first roll in to start the day's work. "Is there really no way to tell who did it?" I asked, squinting at the screen.
"It was a Green," Nico said.
"It might have been a Green," Cole said.
"No," Nico insisted. "It had to have been a Green. How many kids actually know how to erase server activity?"
"Okay," I said. That made sense, unfortunately. "But if they went to such great lengths to hide the other instances, would they have left this blip for someone to find?" Nico shrugged.
"Maybe they were interrupted, or they were in such a hurry they didn't have time."
Cole asked another question that disappeared beneath the rush of blood in my ears as I stared at the screen, blinking to clear the blurriness that turned it into nothing more than a glowing square.
"Think."
Cole touched my shoulder to get my attention, making me jump.
"Sorry,"
I said quickly, avoiding their stares.
"I'm tired. What did you just ask?"
"My theory is one of the computers just glitched, or there's a problem with the server,"
Cole said, his eyes soft with concern.
"Occam's razor," Nico said. "Make the fewest assumptions. The simplest solution is usually the right one."
"I don't know anything about a razor, but who the hell would kids be sending the intel to?"
Cole asked.
"Who'd be stupid enough to try to sell information at the risk of getting their asses caught and hauled into a camp?"
"Could it be someone from Kansas HQ accessing files remotely?" I asked Nico. He shook his head.
"It's someone here."
"Damn."
I shared a look with Cole.
"I want to believe it's a one-off thing," he said, "but keep digging. Let me know if they try anything again, okay?"
There was a knock on the windows running along the side of the room. Kylie, dressed in all black, her hair tied into a poofy bun.
"Ah," Cole said. "That'll be the groups leaving this morning to try to track down those tribes in Montana. You two figure the camera situation out, okay?"
"Wait," I said. "They're leaving this morning? Where did the cars come from?"
"They're taking the SUVs Lee rounded up for yesterday's haul," he said, stretching as he stood.
I followed him to the door, listening to him rattle off instructions about training and which weapons to pull from the locker for training the next day. But when I reached the door, I didn't follow him out into the hall. I stepped back into the computer room and caught sight of the whiteboard out of the corner of my eye. Someone, likely Cole, had started scribbling information on it. Coordinates, camp populations, number of PSFs assigned, anything and everything the League might have had in its files. Peppered through were details from Clancy's documents. I saw tidbits about the camp controllers tossed in like afterthoughts. The basic outline of the Oasis plan was there, too. I found my name written next to Influence Camp Controller in Charge of Communications.
"You don't have to stay," Nico said. "I can do this myself."
"I know." I picked up the dry erase marker from the ledge and started to fill in additional information about Thurmond, fleshing out sections of the plan where I could.
"It was your strategy,"
Nico said over the warm purring of the machines around us.
"Right? It seemed like you."
"What do you mean?"
"A little reckless. Smart, but not giving attention to the details."
"Really?" I said dryly, turning back to face him. He kept his back to me the whole time, shoulders bunched up with tension. I'd really been a monster to him, hadn't I? There seemed to be a 5-foot radius around me that Nico was too frightened to cross. I fought to keep from cringing at the thought of how badly I'd mistreated him.
"How would you do it?"
I jerked my chin in the direction of the blank space under the word Thurmond, trying to ignore the way it seemed to be taunting the both of us. He stared at me, and 60 full seconds of awkwardness passed before he took a tentative step closer.
"It doesn't matter what I think."
"You said I wasn't paying attention to the details," I prompted. "What did you mean by that?" Nico looked down at the floor, running his shoes over the tile. I had a fleeting thought of how Vida used to call the Greens squeakers because of the way they all seemed to shuffle their feet as they walked.
The Oasis plan is okay, he said finally. The way we have it now makes sense. Based on the size of the camp, there'll only be two or three camp controllers, and it'll be easy for you to figure out who is in charge of security and sending the status updates to their network. It won't work that way at Thurmond.
I watched him wring his hands, still unable to look at me.
There's going to be, what, 24 camp controllers in the control tower? That was the estimate in Clancy's files. Its position at the center of the camp means that anyone forcing their way in through the gate is going to have to fight through all of the rings of cabins to get to it to subdue the PSFs and controllers inside. And by then, the camp controllers will have called for reinforcements. Even if you found a way to subdue all of them, it would still be too late. All they'd have to do is turn on the white noise and we'd be done. The power generator and backup generator are all on the camp premises, and I have a feeling cutting the power would automatically trigger an alarm on the military's network.
In the space of 2 minutes, he'd managed to chisel my confidence down to dust.
So we'll need a bigger attack force, one that can work faster, get them in and out.
Liam's idea about trying to get the parents to storm the camp might work, he offered, but its success depends half on us being able to inspire civilians to revolt and come after the camps, and half on whether or not the PSFs would fire on civilians or figure out some other way to deter them.
He has an actual plan? I asked.
Not in the technical definition of the word. I just heard some kids asking him about what he would do.
Nico shrugged.
His option isn't perfect either.
Is there a third option? I asked. Finally, Nico stood up and, with tentative, halting steps, walked beside me. I tried to offer him the marker, but he didn't take it.
Are you sure you want to know?
Try me.
The only way I can think of to disable the camp controller's access to the camp's systems, not even disable or disarm the system itself, but lock them out and keep the system running so no one outside notices anything amiss, is to install a Trojan horse program in their system and control it remotely. They'll be so disoriented that the tactical team will have an easier time of it.
Is that something we could upload into their server? The League had given us a limited education on technology and the way viruses worked, but this was out of my depth.
No, the programs don't install automatically like a virus. Someone has to install it, he said. And with all of the security safeguards in place, I don't think one of them would carelessly download any kind of email attachment.
So someone would have to go into Thurmond and install it before the assault, I said. But the camp has been closed to new kids for years.
They take escaped kids back into the camp they were originally processed in,
Nico said quietly.
I already started coding the Trojan horse. Cole told me to.
I held up a hand to cut him off. Cole approved this already? He nodded, eyes wide.
He said he'd talk to you about it. I can have it ready in a week. They'll be powerless to stop it once the program is installed.
I felt every last drop of blood drain out of my head in horror.
No,
I said, horrified.
No way. I meant me,
Nico said quickly.
Not you. I could bring the Trojan horse program in on a flash drive, the same way we're bringing the cameras into Oasis. Glasses frames. Have you seen them?
Nico crossed the room, retrieving a pair of glasses with black plastic frames. I had to lean against the desk to stay vertical.
Nico.
No.
It's already installed. Right there,
he said, ignoring me and pointing to one of two shiny silver screws that looked like they were holding the frames together.
This is the camera, and this is just a screw the frames don't need. We had to make them seem as real as possible. Tommy said they're fine, so he'll get this pair. For Thurmond, maybe I could take one of the thicker frames, break up one of the arms that hooks behind the ear, and replace a piece of it with a small flash drive. It's either that or embedding it under my skin. But they still do strip searches, don't they? The cut would be too obvious.
Nico, I interrupted. Listen to me. No. There's no way in hell you're going back in there. Even if they brought you back into the camp, how would you get yourself into the control tower to upload it? You haven't been there since the camp changed. They don't just let you walk around unsupervised. Every move you make in there is choreographed down to the minute, and it's the most fortified building in the camp. He paused, trying to think this through.
I'd need to observe the schedules of the PSFs, figure out a moment I could slip away. It doesn't matter if they catch me in the end. Not really. It would be okay. I would get to... There's not anyone left for me now that Kate's gone, and this is how I could make it right.
His voice dropped to a whisper.
This is how I could make it right for Jude.
I stood straight up at that, whirling around to face him fully. Throwing yourself into danger? Throwing your life away? What would Jude say about that? What would Kate say? I haven't been a good friend to you these past few weeks, but Nico, I swear to God, please, I forgive you. I do. I understand what happened, and I'm sorry I treated you the way I did. I've been up in my own head too much, and it was hard for me to see things clearly. But please listen to me.
It's okay.
Nico's voice was hoarse. It's not. It wasn't. It wasn't even remotely all right how I'd been acting, blaming him for everything, hating him because I couldn't function if all of my energy went into hating myself. I tried to think of what Jude would say and do in this situation, or even Kate. All those times she'd had to talk the kid out of a manic fit about some conspiracy. We can't change what happened in Los Angeles. I was angry. I was so damn angry that he just slipped away and I couldn't save him. I should have talked to you, should have helped you, or at least tried to understand what you'd done. I let everyone down, but it was easier to blame you. It hurt less. But the truth is, I knew what Clancy was capable of. I should have tried to confirm some other way that what he said was true. And you know what? Jude would have wanted to go anyway, even if I said no.
He was my best friend,
Nico choked out.
I know, but it's different with Clancy, isn't it?
I said quietly. Rules don't apply when you love someone, and that's how it was with Clancy, right? It's not like how you loved Jude, or the way I love Chubbs. I'd known it the moment I saw his face in Clancy's memory. The tortured expression and the ragged sobs were only part of it. It was the way Nico had held the other boy, how he'd fed him and cleaned him with every ounce of tenderness he had in him. You see it in others, I thought, when you recognize it in yourself. You trusted him, and he took your words and twisted them for his own ends. I said. I was so angry with you for believing him, for giving him everything you did. But I know firsthand that people are capable of doing things for the people they love that they never would have considered before. Nico buried his face in his hands, letting out a shuddering breath.
I didn't mean to ruin everything,
he whispered.
I trusted him. All the intel I gave him, he swore he was using to help us, and I thought...
You thought that he would help keep us away and safe, didn't you? I finished for him. I know. It sounds to me like maybe you fell into my pattern for a while there.
I don't know why. I knew it was wrong, that it was bad, but he was good. When I knew him, he was good and he helped me, and I just extrapolated it would apply to everyone else. The only reason you were there was because I forecast the results incorrectly. I didn't factor all of his behavioral outliers in.
His voice became so small, I had to lean in that much closer to hear him. He wasn't always the way he is now. They broke something in him. I'm sorry, I said, for not letting you explain, for acting the way I did and not being there for you.
I have to fix this, he said, voice ragged. I have to make things right. I can't stop thinking about all of the other outcomes we could have had. Vita said if you hadn't been there, we wouldn't have had the cure, but we don't have it, do we? It was for nothing.
It was a punch to the gut. I felt tears spring to my eyes and fought to hold them back. The pain in him was unending. His life was tragedy upon tragedy upon tragedy. And I'd ignored him, punished him. Vida hadn't made any real attempt. Kate had left altogether. He didn't have anyone to help him through this. We'd stranded him out in a dark sea without so much as a life vest.
We can make it right, I said, taking him by the shoulders. You've done so much already, but there's still so much left. We'll figure out another way.
You have no logical reason to trust me, Nico said.
You may have noticed this about me, but I've never been good at listening to logic.
That's true, he agreed. It's not your pattern. Jude liked that. He said you knew when it was okay to break the rules to help people. He said you were like a superhero, because you always tried to do good things, even if the odds were bad.
Jude's pattern was exaggeration, I said, hoping he didn't catch the hitch in my voice.
Nico nodded, his jet black hair falling forward into his face. He looked sick to me, sick in body, mind, and heart. The pallor of his usually golden brown skin made it look like his ghost had already up and left his body.
Jude never made logical decisions, but he tried.
He tried. He tried so hard at everything with everyone.
Ruby, what does the future look like? Nico asked. I can't picture it. I try all the time, but I can't imagine it. Jude said it looked like an open road just after a rainstorm.
I turned back toward the board, eyes tracing those 8 letters, trying to take their power away, change them from a place, a name, to just another word. Certain memories trap you. You relive their 1,000 tiny details. The damp, cool spring air, swinging between snow flurries and light rain. The hum of the electric fence. The way Sam used to let out a small sigh each morning we left the cabin. I remembered the path to the factory, the way you never forgot the story behind a scar. The black mud would splatter over my shoes, momentarily hiding the numbers written there. 3, 2, 8, 5. Not a name. You learned to look up, craning your neck back to gaze over the razor wire curled around the top of the fence. Otherwise, it was too easy to forget that there was a world beyond the rusting metal pen they'd thrown all of us animals into.
I see it in colors, I said. A deep blue, fading into golds and reds, like fire on a horizon. Afterlight. It's a sky that wants you to guess if the sun is about to rise or set.
Nico shook his head.
I think I like Jude's better.
Me too, I said softly.
Me too.
14. After leaving Nico to his work, I headed to the upper level, barely keeping a lid on the fury ripping through me. It didn't matter, not even for a second, that Senator Cruz was in Alban's old office with Cole and they were having a serious, quiet discussion. I let myself explode into the room. Senator Cruz leapt to her feet and pressed a hand to her chest. Cole only leaned back in his seat.
"He told you," Cole said, his voice flat.
"Yes, he told me," I snapped. "How could you authorize—"
"Shut the door. Ruby."
Cole slammed a hand down on the desk, cutting off my tirade before it could even really begin. The way his voice immediately softened, the pained quality of it, brought me up short.
"Shut the door."
I kicked it shut behind me, crossing my arms over my chest. "It is a death sentence to send that kid into Thurmond," I told him. "He won't be able to handle it, and even if he could, who's to say they'll take him to the camp and not back to Lita's testing program?"
"The one he was in was closed shortly after I got the flash drive out," Cole said.
"Like there aren't others?" I said.
"You were fine with sending Tommy and Pat into Oasis," Senator Cruz reminded me.
She knew about this too? "I'm not fine with it. I don't like it. But they're functioning as eyes and ears only, and we'll have them out within 2 days. Nico won't be able to get away to install the program, and even if by some miracle he does, he won't be able to get away from the control tower once it's complete."
"Then what do you suggest?" Cole asked. "Really, I'm all ears."
I thought of Zoo's reaction to Vida and Chubbs leaving, the pale shock that had wrapped its icy hands over her. If Nico was right, and this was the only way, then it... I took a deep breath in, my fingers curling into fists. Wouldn't it have to be me? Nico was too fragile right now. Being back there would destroy him. But I could, if it helped the people I loved, if it helped every kid that came after us. I could accept that it was the role I was meant to play in this. "They'll kill you," I thought. Clancy had already confirmed what they had done to the other oranges. You would have to convince them again, make them think you're green. I shook my head, trying to clear the thoughts. Last resort. This was a last resort plan. "I think we need to consider Liam's ideas," I said. "Maybe we should go more indirect. Use the media. Get the parents involved. If we take Gray's image down, shake up that last bit of trust people have in him, we can dismantle his government that way. The international community can't ignore evidence of abuse and wrongdoing for long. They'll step in."
"Sweetheart, they've been ignoring evidence for years," Senator Cruz said. "They tried to drop aid into the country, and it backfired. Gray threatened to shoot their planes out of the sky if they crossed into our airspace again. I've tried and tried."
"We just have to get them the right proof," I said. "We can use Lillian Gray's words about the cure and whatever she knows about what caused IAAN to prove it's safe for them to travel in and help overthrow Gray. Haven't there been peacekeeping forces formed in the past?"
"We have a deal, Oasis, for supplies," Senator Cruz said sharply, turning to look at Cole. "Are you reneging?"
"No, I promise you that's not what we're doing," he said, both hands out and placating. "It's natural to have cold feet before an op like this. Can I speak to Ruby alone for a few minutes?"
Senator Cruz rose stiffly, casting an unhappy glance in my direction as she exited the room and pulled the door firmly shut behind her.
"Talk to me, Jem," Cole said. "Tell me what's going on in that head of yours."
"We should keep the plan for Oasis, but I think we need to rethink our approach to Thurmond. Nico won't be able to handle the strain, and we have no guarantee he'd even be brought in. We don't have to be the League, default on a straightforward assault." Cole let out a humorless laugh, rocking back in his chair again.
"Do you know why that became the general strategy? It wasn't always that way.
Alban tried for years to release the truth about Gray and the quality of life in the camps. He tried propaganda, straight-up emotional manipulation. And what messages did get through fell flat. It wasn't that people didn't care. It was that their heads were already in Gray's game, and he told them time and time and time again that if they took their kids out of his camps, they would die. For what Liam's suggesting to work, it's not just about getting the parents there. It's making them willing to come. And if you don't think the PSFs wouldn't open fire on civilians, you are dead wrong, Ruby. Dead wrong.
There hasn't been a situation like this before, though, I said. You can't know for sure.
The metal banged and screeched as Cole reached into the bottom drawer of the desk and slammed it shut again. He stood up and began slapping down sheets of paper across the empty desk, one at a time, lining them up in neat rows, a gruesome echo of the picture's contents. They were... All of those pictures were of kids in those thin, color-coded camp uniforms, black Psi ID numbers across their backs. Some of their eyes were open, but more often than not, they weren't. Some were bloodied, their faces swollen. A few looked like they were just sleeping. The only thing they had in common was the long, empty ditch at their feet.
"Where did you get these?"
I whispered. "Amplify released them a few days ago," Cole said. "I don't think I need to tell you that these aren't doctored, no matter how hard Gray's cronies try to spin it on the news shows."
I shook my head, feeling like I was about to crawl out of my own skin. I would have backed away if there was room to move. As it was, the walls were folding in over my head, falling down over me, crushing, crushing, crushing. I had to get out of this room. My palms were drenched in sweat, too slick to open the door.
Cole grabbed my arm and forced me to stand in front of the desk, forced me to look down at the photos and see them, absorb the blood, the bone, the vacant eyes.
"These are the people we're dealing with," he said. "This is reality. These are people who won't hesitate to kill anyone who interferes with their orders. This is what hesitation has cost us. This is why we have to fight. Revolutions are won with blood, not words. These photos have been out for days. And what have they done to get people involved, angry enough to stand up and protest? Nothing. Ruby, even this isn't enough. They all think they're fake."
"Let me go." I struggled out of his grip, the floor rising and rolling under me. That face. I knew that face, the girl in green.
"No one is going to fight for us, Ruby. We have to fight. We have to end this. Match force with force. Every second we waste circling back and debating the same shit is a second we could be saving these kids from something like this. What do you think sparked this? They were beaten to death. Was it because they tried to escape? They were caught in the middle of a fight? Did some PSF snap? Does it matter?"
Oh my God, I was going to be sick. I pressed my fists against my eyes, trying to remember how it was I usually went about breathing. "These pictures are from Thurmond. This is Thurmond. That girl in green?"
Cole's grip on me tightened. I had the vague sense that he was the only reason I was still standing on my feet.
"I know her. Her name is... was... Ashley. She was one of the older girls in my..."
"In your cabin?" Cole finished. "Are you sure? Maybe you should take another look."
I did, and it changed nothing. I lived with those girls for years. I knew their faces better than I knew my own. Ashley had been at Thurmond for over a year before I showed up, and she took care of us like you'd think a big sister would. She was nice. She was... dead.
"Okay," Cole said quietly. "I'm sorry. I believe you. I'm so sorry. I wouldn't have showed them to you at all if I'd known. The source that sold them to Amplify didn't identify which camp they're from.
Jesus, that ditch. The realization thundered down around me. They were putting them in that ditch? That was what they got? After everything? This? Too late. This was Thurmond. This was real. We weren't going fast enough. I hadn't been able to get to them in time. A swell of bile rose up in me, and I ripped myself out of Cole's grip, collapsing onto my knees. I barely got my face into the trash can before I could throw up everything in my stomach. When I came back to the moment, Cole was holding my hair back with one hand, rubbing a circle across my shoulder blades with the other. I braced my arms against the plastic container and gave in to the sting of tears. Did the source say what happened? I used the tissue he handed me to wipe my mouth. I felt lightheaded, like I was slipping out of the moment, and fought against the pull.
They issued a statement saying one of the PSFs stationed there snuck a cell phone into the camp and snapped the photos.
Ruby, I think... I don't want to believe this, but it seems like too much of a coincidence that this happened and they're closing the camp.
There are over 3,000 kids there, and the other camps are small and crowded. Is it possible they're trying to reduce the population of kids before the move?
They've killed kids before, I said. The ones who tried to escape. The oranges. Reds who wouldn't let themselves be controlled. If this has happened once, it'll happen again. They're going to keep doing this. We're sitting around waiting to get one useful piece of information, and they're dying. This can't just be about evidence. Not for Thurmond. We need to get those kids out now.
I saw the future with sharp clarity, and it wasn't a road. It wasn't a sky. It wasn't anything that beautiful. It was electricity singing through metal chain link and bars. It was mud and rain and 1,000 days bleeding into a stream of black.
Cole must have sensed it, seen it reflected in my face, because he leaned back and finally let me go.
We're going to need actual fighters for the Thurmond hit, I said. Trained soldiers to go in first.
Agreed. Cole said, looking away. Harry offered to help us fight. I wasn't going to say yes. I hate the idea of owing him anything. But we don't have any time to waste now. Nico is right. The only way to shut down the camp's defenses is by attacking them from within. I'll see if I can try to bribe one of the PSFs. Someone has to know someone there.
No. I said, my voice calm. It has to be me. I have to be the one who goes back. A PSF can flip, take a bribe, tip the camp controllers off to what we're doing. If it has to be done, I'm going to do it myself.
The others will never agree to it,
Cole said quietly, but he didn't disagree. He didn't want to stop me. I know, I said. That's why we aren't going to tell them until we have to. Over the next week, the face of the ranch seemed to change. Kylie and the other driver who had gone out looking for tribes returned victorious, even as Liam set out to find Olivia twice and came back empty-handed both times. If he was frustrated by the wasted time and gas, he didn't show it. A part of me wondered if he used the time to get away from all of this for a few hours, taking lovely Rita in the direction of the rising sun and returning in time for the sun to set. The new recruits were willing enough. The group of 5 blues that had come back, Isabel, Maria, Adam, Colin, and Gav, had all served on East River's watch and, in theory, knew how to use weapons. The issue was, after months spent in the wilds of Utah looking like they'd survived a meteor apocalypse, they only took orders from Gav, who didn't particularly enjoy taking orders from anyone, least of all an adult shithead like Cole.
He complained about the cramped sleeping conditions, the plain basic food we ate, the smell of the shampoo, like he was some kind of connoisseur of floral notes and fragrance. Gav was stocky, had a ruddy complexion, and seemed mean enough to want to fight, but only if we begged him. The saga of Gav the asshole ended when Cole hauled him up by the arm from dinner, dragged him into the shooting range, and locked the door behind them. 5 minutes and a muffled gunshot later, Gav came out a team player, and Cole looking far less like he wanted to set the kid's hair on fire. The other tribe was a group of Greens who spent days circling the various computers that the resident Greens now seemed chained to day and night, if only to keep the new hands from tampering with their settings. Only one of the girls, Mila, offered to join the tactical team, but I had to work with her each morning to get her to understand what each hand signal meant, so she'd be able to follow my commands. The third group that arrived, 2 days after Mila's, found us, and we knew them. Nico had spotted the three teens looking around Smiley's, clearly drawn to the crescent moon that we'd painted on the now-defunct bar's door. Kylie and Liam had all but run for the tunnel door to greet them. It wasn't until I saw their interaction on the computer screen, the way Liam pounded the back of one of the guys with shaggy dark hair and tan skin, that I recognized him.
"Friends of yours?"
Cole asked, coming out of the office as the five of them came up through the tunnel laughing, practically talking over each other to get answers.
"You remember Mike?"
Liam said, gesturing to the kid in the Cubs baseball hat. He was thinner than I remembered, a good 10 pounds lighter from stress and the strain of the road, likely, but I knew him by the wary look he cast in my direction. The kid gave me a stiff nod, then turned to accept a bear hug from Lucy. Cole let out a faint whistle at that.
"Not a fan of yours, I take it."
"The feeling is mutual," I assured him. Mike hadn't liked me or trusted me, and had never really wanted to take the blindfold off his eyes about Clancy.
"That's Ollie and Gonzo over there. They're brothers,"
Liam continued, pointing to the two teens standing off to the side. One, Gonzo, I think, had his hand on a makeshift knife made out of a glass shard, a stick, and fabric.
"They were on watch with me. You guys hungry? I think dinner should just about be ready."
I caught his arm before he led the group away. "You can't tell them about Clancy."
"I already did,"
he told me in a thin voice, "and they don't care as long as he stays locked up." "If they try to find him..."
"They won't," Liam said, pulling his arm away. "They're not here for him."
I wanted to ask him what exactly he meant by that, but he was already gone, jogging to catch up to the others. Zoo, who'd been idling nearby in the hall, had come to stand beside me, looking up at me in question. "I'll tell you later," I promised her, because we didn't have time. I didn't have time to think about Liam, let alone constantly seek him out in the garage where he kept to himself. The morning after the Greens perfected the cameras embedded in the glasses, 2.5 weeks before March 1st, Kylie drove Tommy and Pat out of California. They wound their way down surface streets and access roads until they reached Elko, Nevada, the closest town to Oasis that was more than a few houses baking in the desert sun. The boys spent the next few days hanging out at the fringes of town, appearing, disappearing, causing just enough suspicion for some money-hungry soul to call them in for a reward. There was a close call, during which it seemed like the PSFs who collected them were going to take them out of state, up to the camp in Wyoming, but they changed course at the last moment. Their glasses captured everything. We had a front-row seat as the kids were driven up through the desert, as they were processed into Oasis, as they walked through the hallways with their many doors, as they were brought into their rooms, as the PSFs roughed them up a little to show off, slapping Tommy hard enough to knock the glasses off his face. We charted mealtimes, lights out, rotations, and compared the personnel lists on the PSF network to the faces we saw. After one day, we'd already seen the entirety of the premises. The camp was a 2-story building, shrouded from outside eyes by a tall electric fence and canopied tarps, both to keep out the sun and to block any views of the yard from above. We knew that the weekly supplies came at 4:30 every Friday morning. The loud engines and tires chewing gravel and dirt announced their